Well, welcome to Stars, Cells, and God, a Reasons to Believe podcast where we talk about the latest scientific discoveries and how those discoveries give us more evidence for the truth of the Bible and the Christian faith. And we're going to be trying something new today. We're going to be bringing in a member of our scholar community. At Reasons to Believe, we have now 160 scholars in our scholar community. And Jim Painter, who's actually been a visiting scholar with Reasons to Believe, is going to join me for this podcast. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. These podcasts are posted on our YouTube channel. It's a 24/7 channel. You can subscribe for free, and you'll be notified of all the video postings that we're putting up. And there's literally thousands of video postings that you can watch on our YouTube channel. As far as everything else, go to Reasons to Believe RTB_official. And that will be your portal to access all the different features at reasons.org, our blogs, articles, books. You can ask questions. And each of our scholars has a Facebook and a Twitter page. So if questions come up as a result of this podcast, feel free to post your questions on the Facebook and Twitter pages, many of the staff scholars at their Reasons to Believe. Well, as I mentioned, I'm being joined by Jim Painter. And Jim, we met one another at a conference. I thought it was rather interesting. I mean, we're both kind of a little bit up in years. Maybe you don't want to say that about yourself, but I certainly am. But I've been impressed at just your lifestyle of maintaining your body and your mind at tip-top levels. And you gave me some good advice because that's one of my goals as well. So it was a fun encounter that we had. But tell us a little bit about your expertise and background and what have you been doing in the science faith realm?
Well, you know, I became a believer when I was in college because when I entered college the first couple of years, I was just assuming that evolution was true. I mean, you know, the fin becomes a foot And I just believed that. I just thought it was. I remember someone talking to me about Noah and the ark, and I giggled because they, oh, you actually believe that? And they said, yes. And so and then I took my biology classes. So I was an undergraduate biology chemistry major, and I started taking my comparative anatomy classes. And it wasn't too long into that where I realized, wait a minute, I started asking questions. I understand the basic outline of this, but when you go into the detail at all, there wasn't anything there. And I, one time in a comparative anatomy class, asked my professor, I said, but how did the first cell come together? You got this cell, we got the cell wall, you got to get energy in, you got to get waste products out. And then you have to have something inside of it that metabolizes whatever comes in and turns it into energy. And then you have to have it replicate itself. How do you do that? And she said, well, there's this Urey Miller experiment where they had a spark and they had a reducing atmosphere and they produced some amino acids. And I said, okay, I get that. You made amino acids, but how did the first cell start? And she grabbed her shirt and she went, that's all we have. And I thought, that's not enough. And so I quickly started looking then for what's the answer. And then I bumped into Christianity and started looking at the facts. I got Josh McDowell's book, you know, and the day I met you, I had also met Josh McDowell at that same meeting and I was stalking him, you know, to get to meet him. And so that started this whole thing in me and biology and nutrition. I started looking at nutrition and how God built the body and how it fits together. And so my journey over the last 40 years has been exactly that. And most of my teaching right now is built around wellness for the whole person, spirit, soul, and body, because I've been working with the body forever, but there's just things you can't cure with the body. Things like anorexia and bulimia, that's not a nutritional problem. That's a mental problem. And then if you have people full of fear and anxiety and how that changes your immune system, you just can't be healthy if you're walking around in fear, if you don't have the peace of God reigning. So now I look at this as a holistic thing. In 1981, I started at Oral Roberts City of Faith Hospital. So he wanted to combine prayer and medicine. And I was there last week just talking to the deans in the university. And that is still there. That message is still going. And he's one of the few ministers that I see that are in this spiritual faith realm that actually think the body is something other than to be beaten up. And so that's my combination of those has been going forever. And now I direct a master's program in functional and integrative medicine at John Patrick University.
Very good. Now, we live in the United States, and the citizens of the United States are not really known for having good nutrition. And I know that's a passion you have.
Yeah.
And I see that you've got a paper here you want to talk to us about vitamin C. And everybody right. knows we should take vitamin C to avoid scurvy.
Right.
It gives us a little better chance against a common cold. But there's some new insights on vitamin C. As I read this paper, it's a mind blower. So, hey, take it away for us.
Okay. Yeah, I was excited about this paper too. And skeptics challenge us. They look at all these natural disasters and they look at things like cancer that ravages our country. And their question is a good question. How can there be a God if this stuff happens? Either there is no God or God is not good. Because otherwise, how would you have these horrible situations with things like cancer? And so there's a couple of answers for this, but one of it is my mom went through cancer, about six of them. She'd get a cancer, we'd pray about it, we'd go to the doctor, we'd institute some of the stuff he had, and all the while she was really with her physician working on this amazing diet to help herself get through. And one thing about, you say, these horrible diseases, yeah, they are horrible. But in the midst of it, my mother had a brain operation. She had a tumor in her brain. They took out this 3x2-inch tumor and pulled it out, left a hole in the side of her head. She's in intensive care. My brother's in there working with her for 12 hours. I work for 12 hours. He comes home, I'm exhausted. Mom keeps pulling stuff out and she said, I'm exhausted. And I went in and said, hey, Mom. And we started for my 12 hours and she grabbed something. And I say, Mom, what are you doing? And she says, what is this? I said, is Jesus still alive? Well, yes. Is he on the throne? Well, yes. I said, why do you care? And she lay back in bed. So I had this, through this disease, many years, I had this wonderful relationship with my mother. And one time she said, who are those people out there? They think I'm crazy. And I said, Mom, is Jesus still on the throne? Yes. Why? And she'd lay back in bed and fall asleep. Where my brother had to go through this fight, I went through this wonderful thing with my mom. The doctor was coming in one day and I said, Mom, who's the doctor? St. Louis. Where are you? Hospital. What city? Orlando. He walks in and said, what's today? Who am I? And he says, why is she still in intensive care? And I said, well, there's no rooms out there. And they said, okay. And I said, Doc, how about if you let us just take her home out of ICU? And he looked at me and said, I said, you know me, you know my family, everything. Yes. He said, go ahead and do it. And the nurse said, excuse me. And he said, excuse me, nurse, you have a problem? She has a hole in her head. She can't go home. And he said, she's going home, sign her out. So I took her home, you know? And so we've gone through this thing with cancer. You know, we're at home, she's playing cards. I said, Mom, that's a club, not a spade. Oh, I'm sorry. And in about 2 days, we were praying. She's eating well, she's doing stuff. Boop, everything popped back and she lived another 10 years.
Wow.
And so cancer is a horrible thing. It is. But you know, what if God designed our bodies to be able to handle cancer with our immune system, this amazing thing that God made? But what if he's put mechanisms in there to handle cancer once we have it? You know, we are fearfully and we are wonderfully made. And then when the end of this paper, but I want to bring this together with, and I'll say it here, is what if God designed a partnership between us? He didn't for salvation. He did the salvation, but why didn't he just tell everybody about it? He wanted to partner with us somehow to be able to do it. What if he has this amazing immune system, this wonderful DNA, this information, but he somehow wanted to partner with us to keep us healthy? And so that's going to be the conclusion of what I get to. But I just finished Fuzz's class on advanced biochemistry. And we've talked a lot about DNA in the class and the amazing structure and the information in it. Fuzz has been telling us about all these different ways that people are talking about what came first, the metabolism or the information on replication. And he was going through that and they're talking about all these ways that RNA may have been able to get together this way and do this thing and it all come together and it can, you know, connect on certain kinds of clay and that's the way it first started. And all the way through this, I'm thinking, I get it. You can put it nucleotide after nucleotide after nucleotide after nucleotide after nucleotide, put them all together. But you just have a bunch of nucleotides. The only thing that makes DNA important is that it contains information and it contains a code. So you got these three bases code for this protein, for this amino acid that makes this protein. And so even if you figure out some way that haphazardly you might have been able to get some genetic material to form, that doesn't even give you what you have, because DNA contains information. It's a language. It has a code to it. And so as you look at DNA, and we all know this, that DNA, it unwraps and then it replicates itself. But before each gene, there is a promoter region. And so in this promoter region discerns whether this gene gets turned on or turned off. And so the interesting thing in the very beginning, we're one cell. We just have one cell. It has all the DNA. But as they start changing, some of these cells start, you know, damping down on this and increasing this gene, and it becomes a brain cell. And the next cell becomes a heart cell. Next one becomes a bone cell. And so we've got this genetic regulation on these genes, which ones actually gets transcribed and which ones don't. And so this is an amazing balance that God put together. And you've got DNA methyltransferases. So what determines whether this gene gets turned on or not? It's in this promoter region. And in this promoter region, you have these guanine, cytosine islands. And the cytosine in there can get methylated or not methylated. And depending on whether it's methylated or not, methylation tends to turn off the gene, so the gene doesn't get transcribed.
Yeah, let me stop you. What's methylation?
Okay, so methylation. So when you have cytosine, and we'll have a picture of this a little bit later, and you've got this smooth DNA that's just the DNA nutrient bases. It's got the adenine, guanine, cytosine, thymine. And then when molecules out here are going to attach to DNA to replicate it or translate it, then it's going along and there's things that come out. So cytosine is on the outside of the DNA. And if a little methyl group, it's just a carbon group with some hydrogens on it. And if it attaches to there, it can methylate a part of cytosine. Well, that's a signal. And so when you have lots of methyl groups in the promoter region that have attached there, it shuts it off. And so that gene doesn't get transcribed. And so this amazing process that God made to me, you know, it's not just like Fuzz says, wow, that's amazing. Shucks, it must be designed. It's more than that. There's information in there. And there's this amazing code that's there. So you have these methyl transferases that put the methyl group on. And then you've got this other set of TET, 10, 11, and translocation proteins. And these TET proteins then demethylate. So it's this balance between methylating them. And it's not good or bad. It's depending on what they're methylating, what's coming up. And so, you know, this DNA methyl is this big balance. And so what we're finding out now, it's not just that methylation of it, but certain things control that methylation. And this is epigenetics. So the genes don't change. They're the same. Whether you get cancer, don't get cancer, whether you're sick, you're not sick, all depends on what's getting transcribed or not transcribed. And so this DNA methylation in these cytosine, guanine islands that come before the gene that are in the promoter region that get turned on or turned off, other things can do that. So that's called, when we talk about that, it's called epigenetics. It's on top of the genes. So low TET, this TET protein that allows genes to be demethylated, it's found to be very suppressed in cancer. And if that suppression happens in a tumor suppressor gene, and so when you have methylation and they all get methylated and it's a tumor suppressor gene or a DNA repair gene, those two don't work. And so you've got these molecules that are putting the methylation on there. So if you leave it, it keeps them silenced. And so TET is out of balance in cancer. And it seems like that the genes that put it on are more than taking it off in this area of tumor suppression genes and DNA repair genes. And so the interesting thing about this is that we may have some control over what's happening here. So this growing field of epigenetics, when it comes to nutrition, are there nutritional factors that can come in on top of the gene? And can those nutritional factors can methylate or unmethylate? Can they actually help regulate that? And that's what this paper is talking about. Right. When we talk about nutrigenomics, it's the effect of the food on the gene, and it's also the effect of the genes have on the food, nutrigenomics. But nutritional epigenetics is just looking at what nutrition does to turn on or turn off these genes. And I've been spending the last months reading about all of the stuff that's happening now with this whole idea of nutrigenomics and what things work and how they work. And so you look at this, we've got the genome done now and we know what it does. And we know so many genes, but now we have to put it all together. And now with nutrigenomics, we can give people personal nutrition advice. An example is caffeine. What does coffee do? Is it good for people? Well, we've got this guideline, 2 cups might be right. Well, that may be too much for some people because if depending on the gene you have that metabolizes that the substances that are in coffee, like caffeine particularly, if you methylate it, if you handle that well and the genes that are taken care of that are high in you, you will end up, you can drink 5 cups of coffee and it doesn't do anything to you. Where if you don't have those genes being expressed, then you drink 1 cup of coffee and you're into space because you're just buzzing. And so how exciting it is first for me to see this whole idea of epigenetics, where we can have what we eat determine what's being turned on and being turned off. And some of the things I just listened to this last week, looking at this can be carried on. You have one study was looking at very obese men, and they looked at their genes, and there was like thousands of them that were being affected by this weight. And then when they gave them got the bypass surgery, then the bypass surgery lost the weight, and the losing of the weight changed the epigenetics on the gene. Not only that, but it changed then when the sperm was made, when the children came out, what their gene expression was according to what the father had done. That's just mind-blowing to me that it's that we have that much control over it. So this paper, epigenetic regulation of the gene stability, and it talks about that by Brabson. This is new to me. When I first saw this just a couple of months ago, I saw this paper. And like you said, vitamin C is necessary for making collagen proteins that keep our blood in the blood system and keep everything separate. You don't have enough, you get scurvy, which is where blood starts leaking out. You get these patches all over your body, but it makes collagen. And we've known for then years that it's an antioxidant. It stops the initiation of cancer. Because if DNA gets damaged, then that damaged DNA can progress into cancer. And if you have enough of these antioxidants around that stop the free radical damage, then that damage never happens and you can stop cancer before it gets going. But what I found out in this paper, which is so interesting, is that vitamin C also does something about those genes after you have promotion and progression of cancer. And so what he's saying in this paper, Brabson, he found that vitamin C would also help increase the function of TET. So it would help demethylate these genes. And so for the first time then, we found out that altering gene expression could turn on and turn off DNA repair and tumor promotion. And so this was exciting to me when I found out that, wow, not only does vitamin C is an antioxidant, it's a nutrient, helps our bodies build itself, but in the process of cancer, that many times these DNA repair and tumor suppression genes are completely methylated and shut off. And if TET's not around, that's the way it sits. But if you have vitamin C and you add vitamin C to the mix, vitamin C increases TET, it helps to demethylate those and has those function again. So I want to take just 4 or 5 minutes here, and I'm going to share my screen and show you just 4 slides.
Okay.
And I want to, it helps to see these things rather than just talk about them. So I think I have 4 or 5 slides here. So this is what I was talking about. So what vitamin C seems to do is it helps increase the ability of TET to function, and it demethylates this promoter region. And then what happens if this target gene is for DNA repair, it will allow that gene to be transcribed. And then you can have this gene function and it'll improve DNA repair. And it'll also work with the tumor suppressor genes and it'll turn those on. Now I wanted to show this picture because before I read this paper, I must say that my biochemistry of nucleotide bases was not strong. And so I wanted to show you this. When you look, we're going to start way over here on the right. And on the right, you'll see what is cytosine. So here's cytosine. And then cytosine gets methylated right here. That one little thing, because cytosine is in all of these promoter regions. And so if you take cytosine and you then methylate it, that's one methyl group sticking out of the side that's given a signal to all of this out here, whether to take this gene and actually transcribe it. Now, what TET does then, TET just takes this methyl group and it hydroxylates and it turns into 5-hydroxy methyl cytosine. It continues on with this and it creates formal cytosine, and then it continues on to make a carboxy or carboxyl cytosine. And then this can then be transferred back into cytosine. So you've got the unmethylated form. It's kind of a long process, but God is not short in the way he does things. And so what then this paper is talking about is this: high versus low treatment of vitamin C, does it actually affect that TET? Yes, it does. And there's just a number of studies out there. One on human leukemia cell lines, they had a 2-4-fold increase in this and these compounds, demethylating. Human colorectal cancer lines reported a 3-fold increase in the hydroxymethyl cytosine. Oops. And a 10-25-fold in the formal cytosine. And then numerous studies look at cancer cell lines that restored the function. It actually demethylated it to the 5-methylcytosine to 5-hydroxymethylcytosine. So there's ample evidence, as I got into these, some of these studies are a year old or 2 years old that this paper is referring to, giving the basis for all of this.
Now, are these the only cancers that have been investigated, or have they gone beyond leukemia and colorectal cancer and carcinoma?
They've actually done a number of studies. So I would say I looked at a half a dozen, maybe more, studies that are out there. And so these are not, again, so when people look at this, this proves something. Well, this is not an in vivo study. This is not in humans. This is in cancer cells in a test tube. So they have cancer cells, leukemia cells in a test tube, and they test this. So, you know, is this ready for prime time saying, yes, this is going to cure cancers? It's not there yet. It's still in vitro studies, but it is done in a wide variety of cancers. And because, again, my biochemistry on this wasn't strong, I just wanted to show here's cytosine again, these pyrimidine bases. And when you methylate it then, and it's on the outside of this DNA strand, it's a signal. But one of the things the paper talked about is that this methylated cytosine has a 5-fold more likely to undergo mutagenesis. And what I didn't really realize, which is nice in seeing this picture, if you change from cytosine to thiamine, this methylation is already there, same thing here. And all you have to do is deaminate this. And when you deaminate this 5-methylcytosine, you end up with thiamine. So if this happens, you've got cytosine and thiamine that are paired together, and adenine and thymine. So as soon as this cytosine goes to 5-methyl, and it's a trigger for things, it's also more likely to convert into thymine, which causes this match mismatch in the base pairs, which then, again, DNA has the ability to correct those mismatches as they come. And so to end this thing and bring it back to the beginning of, is God a good God? I want to look at Romans 1:20. And Romans 1:20 says that God's eternal power has been known from the creation. You know, since the creation of time, God's eternal power and his divine nature, eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. Wait a minute. God's invisible nature has been clearly seen. Huh? His eternal power and his divine nature. Huh? Through what he's made. Oh, so you can look at what he's made and find out. You can't find the plan of salvation there. But you can find out his eternal power. You look up and you see God's eternal power. You look within and you see God's divine nature in the chemistry. This has amazed me since I was a student years ago. Romans 1:20, the invisible things of God are clearly seen. Not everything, but his eternal power up in the heavens, in his divine nature and how he cares and works with us.
In other words, all of his personal attributes.
Yes, yes. All of his personal attributes show in the way he takes care of us, he provides for us, And the most interesting thing is God partners with us. He doesn't make this system just function. We have to eat. We have to choose to eat the right things to get what we need to be able to get this function. And as you said earlier, Hugh, this is the sad American diet, standard American diet. It is over 50% processed, highly processed foods. These are things with colors, flavors that are added to it, mostly high sugar, mostly low nutrient, mostly very processed white flour that has not much left. And we're eating this. So we have a choice. God said in the beginning, green leafy vegetables, you know, I have given you every herb-bearing seed, every tree in which there's fruit and yielding seed. It's food for you. If we obey God's basic design, we don't even know that this is going on. I just found out about it a couple of months ago that this mechanism that God made for when we eat these foods, what our body does with the vitamin C that's found in there. And this is just a list of vitamin C food. If we just ate whole food, we would be able to get all the vitamin C we need to help our body do this DNA repair.
I know donuts isn't on the list.
I said donuts were not there. I've been looking for a good nutritional quality to donuts and I just haven't found it.
Me neither.
So, you know, when I met you, Hugh, was at that meeting and it was in a break and you had this big box of spinach. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, this is my snack. And Hugh is snacking on spinach. And I thought, man, this guy is, I need to get to know him more because he's actually taking care of his body by snacking on all these good things.
Yeah, well, looking at the paper, I mean, it's making the point that, as you said, it's in vitro studies. But
right.
It's definitely got the potential to say, hey, let's do some actual field studies in hospitals, see right. What happens. But it really does look like that vitamin C would lower our cancer risk. Now, I noticed you talked about cancer cures. I think people could look at this paper, especially those that don't have a biochemistry background, and think, hey, if I just eat gobs of vitamin C, I'll never get cancer. That's not what the paper is saying. It's saying this will lower your cancer risk, possibly by a factor of 2 to 5 times, which would be a good thing to be able to lower our cancer risk that much. And so I'm excited about what potentially could happen with further ongoing studies. But, you know, when we were meeting, we were talking about how, you know, taking different vitamins, Americans either take too little or they take too much. So, yeah, I'm just concerned that when people see this podcast, they're going to go out and say, oh, I'm going to take 30,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day. And you're not recommending that. So what are you recommending in terms of, and I love that little list you put up. Hey, if you just eat these foods, you'll get the vitamin C you need. But I notice in America, people like to take supplements. So what's your counsel on, okay, if you're going to take supplements, what's about the right range if you want to lower your cancer risk and to make sure you got a healthy body, not too little, not too much?
You know, I was going to put this slide in here too, because people are so confused. You've got Atkins here, says eat meat, eat fat. You got Ornish here, it says don't eat any meat, don't eat any fat. And you think, what's going on here? But all of these guys agree on a couple of things. Eat whole foods. The very first thing I say, and people say, you've been studying this how long? 40 years. And all you can tell me is eat whole foods, right? Number one, above all else, should I be vegan or paleo? You missed my point. Eat whole foods, because this body, it's amazing in what it can use as fuel, but it can't use sugar. If you just give it sugar and refined foods, you're missing all this plethora of nutrients. So I just talked about vitamin C, but talk about antioxidants. We've been talking about quercetin that's out there for years and years, and the isothiocyanates that are found in cruciferous vegetables and all of the different phenolic compounds that are found in berries. And I have a whole talk that goes through. And then you look at the good oils that are in nuts and seeds. And so this is what this shows you is if you eat whole foods and God, you don't have to understand the whole system, but it's fun to understand it. But what it tells me is we're never going to know everything. And if you do genetic testing, there's a possibility in the very near future that you can have an idea. Suppose this gene is weak, and instead of needing 60 milligrams of vitamin C, you need 200 milligrams. I mean, that's going to be very possible in the near future. But right. What this tells me and the take-home message for our viewers is eat whole foods. Very, you know, and in those whole foods, you will get all of these things as God designed them in the first place.
Yeah. And I noticed a lot of your lists there included fruits and vegetables. So focus on those, but make sure it's whole. Don't get the processed stuff. And you're mentioning earlier too about, you know, we have this human body. Couldn't God have designed our body so that we would never get cancer? And it is interesting. There are animals out there that where the cancer is extremely low. But when you look at those animals, you notice that their biochemistry is designed to really focus on DNA repair.
Right.
If you focus almost entirely on DNA repair, the animal can't do much else. And God could have designed our body so we would live a lot longer without cancer, but it would be a body where we couldn't be as productive at work as we are or to enjoy vacations like we do. To me, the amazing thing about the human body, unlike other animals, we can live 80 or 90 years at a very high activity level.
Right.
And so that means to have that high activity level, we have to tolerate some cancer risk. But notice other animals like our dogs and cats, they wind up dying of cancer after 10 or 15 years. We get to go 80 or 90 years because of the way God designed our bodies. And that's what amazes me when I look at zoology. The human body is way beyond any other animal body we see. And, you know, God has really optimized us in a great way, but he's also instructed us. I've optimized your body. Here's how to keep it in tip-top form.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. He's optimized us, but we've got things that we need to do. And think of this wide variety of food we have. You've got certain things that just eat one thing. They eat one tree, and that's all they eat their whole life, or just limited amount of food. And all the carnivores, they just eat a variety of three or four animals that they've eaten their whole life. And again, their lives are shorter. They don't live as long. But God has amazingly given us the ability to partner with him and obey what he says, eat the things he's telling us to eat. And he's made it enjoyable. It's just nice to eat a sweet apple. You know, it's good. And you get the savory foods and all the herbs and the spices you can put on the things that are filled with phytonutrients to make food taste absolutely wonderful. And it's a pleasurable thing for us too. But we have to make some decisions in life to you can have a candy bar. I'm not even saying you can't have a candy bar. But if you're eating the candy, sugary stuff all the time, you're in trouble because your body's not getting the nutrients it needs to function. And so we eat nutrients so that we can have the respiration we need, we can burn energy, that we can live, that we can have bodies that are put together right, and all these genes that function and all these enzymes. Enzymes are made all the time that do everything. This thing locks into this gene like this, or this enzyme. And so this enzyme needs to have a magnesium there and a calcium there to make it in just the right form so that this will fit. And if those two things aren't there, it doesn't fit. And so the enzyme doesn't work because you're missing magnesium and calcium that make the enzyme work. So it's a wonderful thing. It's a great responsibility that God has given us to partner with him to keep this body going.
Well, Jim, we're really thrilled to have you part of our scholar community. And I know a number of members of the scholar community really need the counsel that you're providing right here. So hopefully we're going to see a healthier scholar community because of you. And also a healthier Reasons to Believe constituency. And I noticed earlier you were talking about taking Fuzz's course, and you know, part of what Fuzz is actually bringing into his biochemistry is just how amazing it is we have all the elements at the right abundance levels here on planet Earth. You know, you look at the periodic table, and it's so easy to take that for granted. You know, we got 92 elements, and we got them all at the just right abundance. So yeah, I'm going to talk about a discovery about how people can actually copy designs that we see in the human body and use that to extract crucial elements that we see on the surface of the earth and use those elements to sustain our civilization and our health. And one that I'm picking, and it's just one example out of many, but it's uranium. And we can see this next slide here on uranite, often called pitch blend. I grew up in Canada, and this is a common mineral in Canada. Canada is one of the big uranium producers in the world. But what's interesting about uranium compared to the cosmic abundance. If we compare how much uranium we see in the interior of the Earth and the crust of the Earth compared to what the average is for rocky bodies elsewhere in the universe, Earth is ahead by a factor of 340 times. We have 340 times as much uranium per unit volume as any other rocky body in the universe. And you say, why is that important? Isn't that radioactive? Well, the radioactive decay of uranium is an important feature of the heat flow in the interior of the Earth. And it's that heat flow that produces plate tectonics. So we have a planet with oceans and continents. It also provides the heat that's necessary to produce our magnetic field and our magnetosphere. You know, a unique feature of our planet Earth, it's had this strong, very stable magnetosphere that shields us from being killed by cosmic and solar radiation. You know, and this next slide actually shows that we not only have a superabundance of uranium in both of its elemental forms, 230 isotopic forms, 235 and 238, we also have a lot of thorium. We have 610 times as much thorium as the average rocky body elsewhere in the universe. You know, I often tell people, planet Earth, we're sitting on the uranium-thorium champion of the universe. But it's because we're sitting on such a uranium-thorium-rich body that we're able to have continents and oceans. We're able to recycle the nutrients that you're talking about. You know, it's one thing to have nutrients, but if you're not recycling them, then we're not going to have the healthy animals and plants that we need. And plate tectonics does that. And then we have that magnetosphere. And this next slide actually show you a nuclear power reactor. Because yes, uranium does amazing things to sustain it, but it's also a source of energy we can use to drive our economy. And so this is the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant that exists here in California. And so people, I think, are quite aware of the value that uranium has to produce energy without having to increase the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. I mean, everybody's concerned about global warming. One way to deal with that, hey, let's transfer energy needs from fossil fuels to uranium reactors. And incidentally, I'm a real fan of thorium nuclear reactors because with thorium, you've got a cheaper product that you can mine. And there's no possibility of a nuclear power plant meltdown. And you can't use it to make weapons. And there is the nuclear waste is much easier to deal with. Instead of a 50,000-year decay time, you got a less than 200-year decay time. But unlike thorium, uranium has significant industrial uses. And so here I'm actually showing a projectile that's used to penetrate things. So this is actually a weapon that's used to penetrate tanks. And what they're doing here is they're taking uranium and stripping it of U-235. That's the stuff that's deadly. So this is just what they call denatured uranium, where you got the uranium-238, and with a half-life of 4.5 billion years, you're actually not at risk from radiation exposure from this denatured uranium. In fact, your biggest risk is that you might get some shavings off the uranium that wind up in your diet. Uranium oxide is not good in your diet. So it's one of the things you don't want to be eating a lot of. But hey, the wonderful thing about uranium metal, it's extremely hard and extremely dense. And so the risk of getting something off of it into your diet is very low. So it's easy to safe and easy to handle, but it has a lot of other industrial uses in the sense that it's so very dense and so very hard that we can use it as a shield. So it's actually better than lead to shield us from radiation because of how dense and hard it is. And you know, if you want something to shield you from impact, there's nothing better than denatured uranium. So I'm anticipating that as our civilization continues to expand, we're going to have a greater and greater need for industrial uranium. And as to where uranium comes from, this is where it comes from in terms of the different continental regions of the world. Kazakhstan has the largest store of easy to mine uranium. Canada is second, Australia's third. And right now, the uranium production is about 70,000 tons worldwide. That's not a lot of uranium. If we're talking about expanding the industrial application of uranium, we're going to need a lot more than 70,000 tons. And this is what this paper is all about, is that if we really want to expand uranium technology, we're going to have to find a richer source of uranium. And the continental land masses actually have quite a bit, but the proven resources on the continental land masses is only 8 million tons. That's the total reserves of uranium on the land masses. But as you can see in the oceans, we're looking at 4.5 billion tons, not million tons, but billion tons. And some estimate that the oceans might contain as much as 10 billion tons of uranium. That's 1,000 times as much uranium as you got on the land. But the problem is, how do you extract that uranium from the ocean? You know, uranium is soluble in water, so it's dispersed in the water, but it's dispersed in the water at a rather low level. As you see here, it's only 3.3 parts per billion. So how do you extract that uranium out of ocean water? And that's the whole point of this paper. They said, if we copy the designs we see in the human body, we can actually economically extract that uranium from the ocean and basically put all these uranium mines out of business and have enough uranium that we can greatly expand the industrial use of uranium far beyond we have today, drop the price way down, and be able to increase the industrial application of all this amazing uranium that God has put on our planet. And I think you'll like this, Jim. What they did is they copied the designs we see in human blood vessels. And if you look at the human blood vessel, the membrane is basically a fractal system. You know, so it's got this very complex fractal geometry built in, which allows these blood vessels to very efficiently bring nutrients in and bring nutrients out at just the right level, so they can put out a lot at certain places, very little other places, or actually close it all up. And so what some bioengineers did is they looked carefully at these human blood vessels, copied the membrane fractal designs they saw there, and used this to build a membrane that can extract uranium out of the ocean. Now, it's kind of like the paper you discussed. They didn't actually test this in the ocean. They basically did it in a test tube. They made a membrane, put it in a test tube, and then basically worked to see how efficiently this could work. But in this slide, we get to see that inspired by the high mass transfer efficiency of a natural fractal network, such as those found in human blood vessels, these chemists engineered a membrane, built a membrane that had led to a 20 times improvement of extraction of uranium from seawater. And a factor of 20 improvement over existing membranes is sufficient to basically put all these landmines out of business. It'll be, in other words, if we can scale it up where we have these huge membranes sitting in seawater, we're going to be able to get enough uranium out of that. And basically made the point that the membrane adsorption capacity after just 7 days adds up to 6.63 milligrams per gram. That's more than sufficient to make this economically viable. But they said if you let it sit for 28 days, 4 weeks, you actually push it up above 9 milligrams per gram, which means we have the capacity to pull a lot more industrial useful uranium out of the oceans at basically limitless amounts, because we're talking more than 1,000 times as much as what we have on the land masses. It's all safe because you're all doing it under ocean water. You don't have to have protective gear or anything. You can basically put these giant membranes in seawater, scrape off the uranium, and basically use that for industrial application. Now, what's exciting to me, that's all this paper talked about was doing this for uranium. But I'm thinking, hey, we can actually use the same bio-inspired technology because the oceans are filled with all kinds of soluble metals that are extremely valuable. And so we can do this. And notice too, that you're not having to burn a lot of fossil fuels to extract this stuff like you do with mines, where you got to have all these different industrial factors here. So this is actually a very green way to pull these vital metals that we need for our industrial applications out of the oceans. So like you, I'm looking forward to future publications where they say, hey, we've proven this works for uranium. We think we can make it work for other industrial metals. And actually, this would be a huge boost to our economy. It would actually lower greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And from a biblical perspective, I see God saying in the early chapters of Genesis and in the book of Job, I've put you human beings on planet Earth. I'm making you responsible to manage the resources of Earth for your benefit and the benefit of all other life, which means God in advance has designed our planet in such a way that we will find win-win solutions. And I look at this paper and saying, this is an example of a win-win solution where we can improve our economy, improve the economic well-being of all the peoples of the world, and take better care of our planet and the world's ecosystems at the same time.
That's amazing. So is it anywhere near the possibility of making this now something, you said it's financially doable, but is it practically doable yet? And how long might that be before we can start doing this kind of a thing?
Well, this is a proof of principle experiment. As I said, they kind of did it in the lab in a giant flask. They know it works. The next problem is scaling it up. I mean, instead of using a membrane that's got a surface area of 100 square centimeters, you want to get it up to where it's square kilometers. So, but the oceans are big. There's lots of room to put these membranes in and to put them in places where it's easy to monitor the membranes and then be able to take the uranium off the membrane. And you're basically designing the membrane to target a particular dissolved metal in the ocean. So that's what they're doing here with the uranium. But yeah, it needs to be scaled up. And the first point is to get enough people aware of this paper that they say, why aren't we doing this tomorrow? That's the first step. You need to basically excite the investors saying, hey, this is something where I can make a lot of money and it's going to help mankind. And I'm going to start making it happen. So proof of principle is always the first step towards any engineering development.
Right.
I'm confident it can be easily scaled up.